You'd like to be turning to Daniel chapter 9. We will continue our study in Daniel. Now, as we mentioned last week when we started chapter 9, this latter part of chapter 9 is one of the most difficult passages in the Bible, and it's been a quagmire of people trying to interpret it in all kinds of different ways. And so I'm going to try to give a little brief overview of some basic approaches that people tend to take, just so we are familiar with how others might try to interpret these things. And of course, the challenge is always to see which explanation best accounts for all of the facts as we have them. And so I'm sure we'll take all the class time dealing with a lot of these fundamental overview issues. So if there are any knotty problems left, ask Nathan about those next week when he resumes teaching. But I joke about that, I guess. We'll try to cover anything that's pertinent. All right, so there's four basic approaches that people take to Daniel chapter 9. And by this, we're focusing on the latter few verses here. I guess we should go ahead and read these to get us before them, so some of this will make some sense to us if you haven't had a chance to do this yet. We've had the prayer of Daniel that occupies verses 4 through 19, and the setting of that prayer we saw in the first three verses was that Daniel was reading his prophecy of Jeremiah and saw that the prophecy of Jeremiah, he had decreed that 70 years of captivity and God was going to bring the people back, and he could count, and he could tell that the 70 years is pretty much coming to a close, and yet he apparently understood that return would be conditional upon the people's repentance, and so he's providing some leadership and contributing his own efforts toward that very kind of repentance that the law had called for, and so that's the substance of his prayer. Now notice verses 20 through 23. We get a answer to this prayer, in essence, sent by Gabriel, none other than the angel Gabriel. And he says, "While I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin," and again, you see, that's what we were emphasizing last week. It isn't just Daniel praying and saying, "Oh yeah, I'm got stuck with a bunch of rotten people here, and so as a group, be merciful to the nation." But he's sensitive to his own sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God in behalf of the holy mountain of my God, again the destroyed temple, while I was still speaking in prayer, at that very moment the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering. And he gave me instruction and talked with me and said, "Oh Daniel, I have now come forth to give you insight with understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued. And I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed, so give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision." I've come to give you a vision. God's giving this to you because you're held in particular regard by the Lord. And I've often thought, wouldn't it be something if the Lord could certainly look down on any one of us with that same kind of regard? Doesn't mean he's going to send us a vision. But the thing that's extraordinary about Daniel is his faith, and we can have that kind of faith too, and have that kind of relationship with God and praying to God and so on. So it's fascinating to me that as soon as Daniel opened his mouth and began praying, which means practically back at verse 4, God already answered his prayer. You see, what a waste of time. Daniel didn't even need to bother with all the verses 5 through 19. God had already answered the prayer. Well, that, of course, is to look at it kind of economically. You know, if I pay so much and God gives me something in return, and you know, it's kind of like haggling with somebody, and you know, you offer to buy something for $10 and they easily take it, and you think, "Oh man, I offered too much to begin with. I should have offered a lower amount to begin with." And that's kind of how we think about prayer. You know, "Oh, I shouldn't have felt like I needed to pray so hard. God was going to answer my prayer." No, God, I suspect, knew what was in Daniel's heart and knew what he was already going to say before he said it. And even more importantly, the fact that God takes such concern for Daniel's prayer and immediately responds to answer the prayer. That's very important. We're going to come back to that here in a minute. So God issued some kind of command at the beginning of his prayer. So the moment Daniel began praying, God said, okay, we're going to do this. Let this be done. And just on the face of it, what do you suppose that command would be? What was it the Lord decreed would happen? Flapjacks for everybody. Is that what God decreed? No? What would make the most sense? Okay, the people would return. That's the thing Daniel was praying for, that the people would go back to the land, and not just to return to the land, but that the city would be rebuilt and the temple would be rebuilt. Again, as he was praying on behalf of the mountain, the holy mountain of God, in verse 20, the thing that David's particularly, the thing that Daniel's particularly focused on is the state of the temple. And the people going back and restoring that, rebuilding that, and what that represents of their restored relationship with God. And so, at least on the surface, it would appear that the very thing Daniel was praying for, next time I say David, someone just come up here and slap me, okay? The very thing Daniel was praying for, God has answered that at the beginning of the prayer. All right. Now here's the vision, verse 24. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place or person. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, until Messiah, the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It'll be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then, after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the Prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood. Even to the end there will be war, desolations are determined. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, and in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. All right. So the traditional messianic interpretation, I guess we might call this, and this pretty much would describe my basic approach to Daniel chapter 9, is that the 490 years are symbolic, although they also are approximately the right period of time. You're talking about a period of something between 500 and 600 years, actually. But going from at least what's described here, this doesn't necessarily entail the 70 weeks itself, because we don't know exactly what event might mark the end of the 70 weeks, because nothing is said about that in the vision. But the destruction of the city and the temple is certainly mentioned in verses 26 and 27, so that at least takes us down to the time period of AD 70. And the decree to return and to rebuild would take place with Cyrus, the Persian emperor, in 539. And so, again, you're talking about a period of over 500 years, but what's most important is the symbolic number, and we'll see that a little bit later here. The first 7 weeks, you'll notice again these weeks are broken up. You have 7 weeks and another 62 weeks, and then that last week. So you have 7, 62, and 1. And after this first 7 weeks, the temple and the city are rebuilt. And, of course, that's going to happen, of course, when the people return, they start rebuilding the temple, but they don't actually finish. They do rebuild the altar of burnt offering. And then, you know, the prophets Haggai, Zechariah have to come and encourage the people to begin rebuilding. And so from about 520 to 515, the temple is worked on. And so it's finally finished about 515. And so again, 7 weeks, with each day representing a year, 7 times 7, 49 years. So again, that symbolic number is actually greater than the actual amount of time that will pass until the temple is rebuilt. But of course, the rebuilding of the city itself still takes place over a period of time, because, you know, even down in Nehemiah's day, which you're talking about 444, the walls still haven't been rebuilt adequately, at least. And so he's come back to do that. And so there perhaps isn't a single date that we could fix to say, oh, on this date, finally the city has been rebuilt and restored and the temple has been finished as well. You know, it's easier to fix the end of the rebuilding of the temple, but the rebuilding of the city itself is a more vague kind of thing. But again, it's symbolism that the vision is concerned with, more importantly. So Jesus is going to appear, or the Messiah, and of course we believe Jesus is the Messiah. So he's going to appear at the end of that second group, that 62 weeks, so 69 weeks altogether. And then in that last week, at least after the events or during the events of that last week, we'll see the destruction of the temple again in AD 70. So that's, again, pretty much the format I'm going to be looking at as we look at this in more detail. Another view, I don't run into that many people that hold this view, but the church age interpretation. Again, the 490 years are completely symbolic, and by that I mean they don't even approximate the actual number, because we're still in the 490-year period in this view. The first 7 weeks covered the period from the Edict of Cyrus in 539 down to Jesus' first coming. So that first 7 weeks covered, you know, that 500-plus years. And the next 62 weeks then represents the current church age that we're in. And if the church period continues to go on for another 10,000 years, that's going to be part of this 62 weeks. And then that last week is a period of turmoil that will happen just before the end, that things are going to kind of get worse, and God's going to decide to wrap this whole thing up and be done with it. And that's what's going to happen during that last week. So that's just to acknowledge, again, another kind of approach that some take. A third approach is the Maccabean interpretation, and this is what's followed by all of your modernists. If you were to study Daniel in a state university, typically this is the view that they would take. They would say the 490 years are literal. It's actually a really actual 490 years from about 587, 586, that's that destruction of the temple, the third final phase of the Babylonian incursion and destruction of the city and the temple, down to 146, 145. And of course, if you know your intertestamental history, this is where, you know, the Greeks had begun severely persecuting the Jews and had even sacrificed a pig on the altar in Jerusalem. Not so much apparently because the Greeks said, oh man, these Jews really hate pigs and we're really going to stick it to them, but pig was considered one of the prime sacrifices to Zeus. And they were on this campaign to say, well, your God Yahweh is the same as our God Zeus, just different names for the same guy. And so as part of this kind of a syncretism and merging together of their religion, they were going to offer a pig on the altar. Well, you couldn't think of anything more offensive to a Jew, a faithful Jew. And but even that didn't provoke the rebellion. It wasn't until this kind of low official in the Greek government goes to this little backwater town and asks the village elders to pay homage to the emperor, and make the sacrifice, and Matthias, the elderly priest there, he wouldn't do it. And this young Jew said, well, we don't want no trouble in this town. And he steps forward to save the village from any trouble. And this gets Matthias all upset. And so he kills the young Jew and the Greek official that was there. And of course, the fat's in the fire then. So that's what kind of precipitated this Jewish revolt, the Maccabean revolt, led by him and his sons. Well, they were able to win a number of great victories over the Greek armies, and eventually retook Jerusalem, retook the temple, rededicated it, and so on. And that's what Hanukkah, you know, celebrates and all of that. So this is the time period that it comes down to. And so the view of the modernist is that Daniel of, you know, Babylonian and Persian fame is not the guy that actually wrote the book. It obviously had to be some guy living in 145 BC because he knows all this stuff happened and he tells about it in the book. And the only way anyone could do that, since there's no such thing as real prophecy, he'd have to be writing it after the fact. It'd be like if I wrote some supposed prophecy of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and wrote about it in great detail and all that, people would read that and say, that wasn't a prophecy. You wrote that after it happened. Well, and that's what they're saying the book of Daniel is. And so what they envision happens is that the first 7 weeks represents from the destruction of the temple until the return. So it's a literal 49-year period that happens. And then that next 62 weeks, which brings you right up to the current writing of the book, supposedly. Whatever day this guy was actually writing out the book of Daniel, he was expecting the Messiah was going to show up any day. And of course, that didn't happen. And so this is an example of failed prophecy, and there are several such things that they try to see in the book of Daniel. And so the last week would be the new age that the Messiah would usher in. But unfortunately, this expected Messiah never came, and it was a failure and a flop, and so that didn't work out too well. Well, I'm sure most of us wouldn't be too interested in that interpretation. But one final interpretation, this is the one you will find much more commonly among conservative, evangelical, religious people. It's the dispensational, you can't call it the premillennial view, because some premillennialists would hold some of these other views that we've talked about. But dispensational premillennialism, which is a different kind of premillennialism, this is their view. And they also say the 490 years is to be taken literally. The problem with the dispensational view is that last week, that last 7 years, never happened. So it's kind of similar to the Maccabean view in that sense. And so it got postponed. So if you're familiar with the dispensational view, the basic tenet of that view is that God wanted to reestablish the kingdom of David, and that's what Jesus came for, but because the Jewish people rejected Jesus and put him to death, God couldn't implement his plan, and so he just put it on hold. And so one day Jesus is going to come back and pick up where he left off, which I always wonder, why can't we kill him again? You know, or God's going to bring a bigger army this time and keep it from happening. I don't know what. But it just doesn't make any sense to me, because if anything is prophesied in the Old Testament, it is the suffering of the Messiah. It is his very rejection and crucifixion. This was not an accident. It was not something unforeseen by God. This is the very plan and purpose of God from the very beginning. So it's completely contrary to my most basic fundamental understanding of the Bible. But that's their view. And so the first 69 weeks out of the 70 weeks takes us from 444 BC, which that's not the decree of Cyrus in 539 that the Jews could go back to the land and rebuild their temple and so on, but that's Nehemiah's, you know, receives his approval from Artaxerxes to go back and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So that's the decree. Well, the reason they have to do this is because this is the only way the math's going to work out literally. And the one thing that drives dispensationalists is every prophecy has to be fulfilled absolutely literally. And so they can't start with the decree to return by Cyrus. They have to start with Artaxerxes, all right? Now, another thing they have to do is, it's not really 490, take off the 49 years. That's 476 years is what it works out to be. Because they calculate a year differently. A year is not really a 365-day year. It's 360-day years. And again, the reason they have to do that is to make the math work out right. And so they do some kind of fudging of things to make all this work. If you try doing the math and it didn't make any sense to you, you'll understand why. And the crucifixion of Jesus then has to be in AD 33, okay, which is possible. I think it's more likely it was in AD 30, but it can't be in AD 30 according to them. That would ruin their math. So they have to fix it on those two particular dates. And then the 69 weeks end with Jesus' triumphal entry. You know, Jesus, that's the height of it. You know, Jesus is coming into Jerusalem. The Jews are all acclaiming him as the Messiah and welcoming him with open arms. But then it went downhill from there. And so that's where God stopped his prophetic clock from ticking. And we've been in this hiatus now for over 2,000 years, or some 2,000 years. And so the 70th week then has been postponed. And of course, that 70th week is also that 7 years of the Great Tribulation and the Rapture and the Battle of Armageddon. And all of that that goes on in the book of Revelation is interpreted in connection with this 70th week in Daniel. So you'll run across a lot of people that will be interpreting the passage from that perspective. Well, just are there any basic questions about these general approaches? Or, well, if you're like me, you'd be more interested in actually looking at the text and seeing what we might learn from that. So I want to talk about three fundamental keys that will help us to interpret Daniel chapter 9 correctly. And I think these are critical. I think they're pretty easy to establish and have confidence in, so I think we can use them to guide us in our study rather than just making up some point of view and trying to force it onto the text type of thing. So the first is to see the vision of the 70 weeks in the context of Daniel's prayer. I said we'd come back to that, and I think this is just critical, and this is one thing that dispensationalists just pretend has no connection whatsoever with what Daniel has been talking about. So the 70 weeks prophecy now is God's answer to Daniel's prayer. It's the answer itself was the issuing of the command in verse 25, and then as part of that response to the prayer, God, because Gabriel says Daniel is esteemed by God, God gives him this kind of insight, vision of the future, what the future holds for God's dealings with his people Israel. And so the command that is mentioned in verse 23 in the context can only refer to the command for the people to go back and begin rebuilding. Now, the reason the dispensationalists want to quibble and say, oh no, Artaxerxes is the one who you have to date it from, because Artaxerxes is the one who gave the official approval for the people to go back and rebuild the city. And that didn't happen down to the 400s. But you may remember in Isaiah, the prophecy that predicts Cyrus as the one God was going to raise up as his anointed to bring the people back to the land, in Isaiah's prophecy is included, he will rebuild my city. And so obviously for the people to come back, some degree of fixing Jerusalem to make it inhabitable had to take place. It may not have been thoroughly finished or all the walls built and things like that. But the important thing is that the people come back. And even more important than that all the walls of Jerusalem are rebuilt is that the temple is rebuilt. And that begins immediately when the people, Cyrus issues his decree, the people come back and they start restoring the temple. They rebuild the altar of burnt offering first thing so they can begin offering their sacrifices again. So this commandment of God's must be, again, okay, I said I will let the people go back, that let it happen. Okay, I'm now decreeing that the captivity is over and the people are to go back. That would be God's commandment. God's in control of all these things. So behind the scenes, this is God's command. And then what we might call the earthly counterpart of that would be Cyrus issuing his decree in 539. But again, the Bible reader understands that wasn't Cyrus's idea. It wasn't just he made a decree and he allowed the Jews to go back to the land. Behind that, it was God's will that that happened. And so there's God's decree in the matter, and there's also then again how that gets done on the earth under the authority of Cyrus. But as Isaiah had said, Cyrus is God's anointed one, his chosen one, to accomplish that very purpose. So in the context again of this prayer, we can't put it off till Artaxerxes in the 400s. It has to be Cyrus' command. And this clay cylinder here is one of the actual records of the Persians that records this decree of Cyrus that the peoples could go back to their lands and rebuild their temples and so on. Now, if we don't look at this decree that is given for the people to come back as happening immediately, then you got 100 years that go by before anything really happens or before the decree is issued by Artaxerxes. Well, that's a 100-year delay, right? But now, notice verse 19. What did Daniel pray for?
Do not delay.
Do not delay. Now, it'd be kind of odd if Daniel is so esteemed by the Lord that even when he just opens his mouth and starts praying, the Lord is eager just to start answering that prayer at the very beginning. The one of the very things that Daniel's praying for, don't delay. Oh, you're esteemed by the Lord, and I'm going to answer your prayer right away. Well, no, not really. I've got to wait 100 years before this is going to happen. That just seems to be odd. And then especially when you compare that with verse 23, the kind of urgency, the immediacy of it. I mean, in context, again, you have to understand Gabriel is saying, God has answered your prayer from the moment you open your mouth. And so he has issued this command for the people to come back to the land and rebuild the temple. And that's now going to happen. So I think we can pretty definitively establish the beginning of this 70 weeks with the issuing of this decree. Again, you remember the date of this is in the very first year of the Persian king Cyrus. And almost immediately, one of the first things he does is issue this decree for the people to come back to the land. And so that's got to be the time that this 70 weeks begins. And so that's what's going to begin this period of time that we're talking about in this 70 weeks. All right, so any questions about that? See, I think that you can be pretty confident of that. That's the only thing that makes any sense. Anything else is just wiggling and crunching numbers and jimmying things. And before you know it, May 21st is when the Lord's going to start the end of the world. The Bible guarantees it. Okay.
So Daniel, at this point in time, where he's alive, do you know about this? What year would that be?
This is 539. Yeah.
And so then, I had a question about verse 23, the word that goes out in verse 23.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the expression of God's authority or will that this happen. That's my understanding.
Because he comes back in verse 25 and he does talk about from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem. trying to understand. Well, in verse 25 and the word in verse 23, the same thing?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think, yeah, I wouldn't draw a big distinction here between, because in essence what this vision is it's more than just the decree to return, but that's the beginning point.
Yeah.
And so at the moment you open your mouth to pray, God already answered that prayer. He's issued the command for what's going to happen, and it isn't just the return, but all these other things that'll happen as well. So I guess you could say the package plan that God has is all of these things that are mentioned in verse 24 and following, but it starts with the return of the people. All right. The second key to interpreting Daniel are the six goals that are mentioned in verse 24. So 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to do these six different things. So we know that these six things have to happen sometime during the 70-week period, all right? And so some of these things may help us to pin this thing down a little bit. So the first thing is to finish transgression. Well, that's an ambiguous statement. You can stop transgression by killing the people that are doing it. I'll put it into your transgression. Or you can bring them to repentance where they stop sinning. And of course, there's really a sense in which it's often both, where the people that are righteous or sensitive to God do repent, and those that don't are judged. So that's a little vague, you might say. But at this point, if I were to ask you, if you had to pick one event out of the entire Bible that you would summarize as the quintessential putting an end to sin, what would it be? Jesus. I mean, that's the only way the problem of sin is really addressed and solved anywhere in the Bible is the sacrifice of Jesus. That's it. I mean, no animal sacrifice ever did that. And if Jesus didn't do it, ain't nobody going to do it, right? So if you just had to pick one thing that just you have a gut feeling, that's probably what it's talking about, I would have to go with the sacrifice of Jesus. All right, the second thing is to make an end of sin. Not quite too much different from the first one. And again, we have the same issue of whether it's repentance or judgment, or a little bit of both. And then to make atonement for iniquity. And that probably would help us kind of judge what the other two are. The way sin is really going to be finished off is it's not that people have stopped sinning altogether, and I'm free of sin completely, but through the sacrifice of Jesus, if there has been any atonement, anything that qualifies as true atonement, it would have to be, again, the sacrifice of Jesus. And that brings us back, of course, to the very point that instead of there being this gap during which the crucifixion takes place, it really is about the crucifixion more than anything else of what the Messiah is going to accomplish when he comes. To bring in everlasting righteousness. Again, in the context of the Bible, you have to go with Jesus. The only way man can be righteous before God is not of his own moral greatness, but through Jesus Christ. We are righteous in Jesus Christ. To seal up vision and prophecy. Now, this can be taken two ways. I think a lot of people take this to mean that vision and prophecy ends. It stops. It's finished with. And I wouldn't say that I'd have a problem with that, because pretty much with the close of the New Testament age, you do have the cessation of vision and prophecy. But it seems to me more likely it's the idea of fulfillment. That if, again, in the context of what Gabriel is saying to Daniel, it seems to me the point that he's making is God is going to reveal to you what he is going to do with his people up to the end. And the Messiah is going to come, and he is going to fulfill everything that has been predicted and prophesied that in fact, anything that really qualifies as a vision or a prophecy in the Old Testament ultimately was pointing to Jesus, the Messiah. And so when the Messiah comes, he will seal up those visions, seal up those prophecies. He will fulfill them and bring them to pass. And so again, I think we're talking about the climactic point in human history and God's dealings with people where he brings all of this to pass. He brings an end to sin, an atonement for sin, fulfillment of all that the Old Testament has prophesied. Again, that has to be Jesus. And to anoint the most holy, and there's no object given. So is it a person? Is it a place? The temple? Well, in Jesus, again, it's both, because you have the temple of his body and the church, which is God's temple and so on. So, again, I think clearly the most full and complete anointing that ever happened was in Jesus. The word Messiah means anointed one, the fact that he is the anointed one. So all of that points, again, I think quite clearly to a fulfillment in the coming of Jesus that first time. And then there's some other factors to consider in this as well. Verse 25 clearly mentions that the city of Jerusalem and the temple are going to be rebuilt. And that again happens, immediately upon the return of the people. They start that, gets finished sometime later, and then at various stages the city continues to be worked on. The appearance of the Messiah and his cutting off, and I don't know any way to read that but as a reference to the crucifixion. Surely that's what verse 26 is talking about, right? So I can be pretty certain about that. Sacrifice will come to an end, and the city and the temple are going to be destroyed a second time. That's pretty clear, and we know exactly when that happened, too. That happened at the hands of the Roman army in AD 70. The destruction of the temple brought an end to the offering of sacrifice. That's on the physical side of it. Even earlier than that, you could say the crucifixion of Jesus brought an end to any real sacrificing, because the animal sacrificing that the Jews were doing after that point wasn't doing any more than killing an animal. It had no, power under the old covenant any longer. And then there is a covenant that is confirmed in verse 27, which could be a reference to the establishment of the new covenant with God's people now, which is a Gentile as well as Jew, or a new stage of the covenant of Abraham, which is the same as the new covenant. Either way, you could take that. So I think we can be pretty confident that the end of the 70 weeks must be, again, we can't fix a definite event that marks the end of the 70 weeks, but what it ends in is the rejection of God by his people again, and therefore a second judgment of destroying the city and the temple. And so eventually the destruction of AD 70 does enter into the picture. But was that rejection earlier? I mean, some people identify the stoning of Stephen, the Jews' first killing of a Christian, as being the definitive place or whatever. But there's no way to pick a particular event. But again, you see we're talking about just a matter of a year here and there. So I think we'd be pretty certain when this period ends as well. And then finally, the symbolism of the 70 weeks is what is helpful to us. We've talked about this a little bit already, and hopefully the sermon last week will help somewhat. So the 70 years of captivity were symbolic that for 490 years, and again, that doesn't have to be an exact number, but 500, 600 years, pretty much ever since Joshua and his generation died, the people have been unfaithful. And that takes you back to the period of the judges and through the period of the kings. They've been unfaithful. In particular, they've not been keeping the Sabbath year law. And as God said in Leviticus, if you don't keep it, I'll make you keep it. And I'll carry you off into captivity, and I'll get those Sabbath years one way or the other. And the book of Chronicles ends with telling us that 70 years have been decreed of captivity to get those 70 Sabbath years back, which implies the 490 years we've been talking about. So what Daniel is saying here, in essence, is God is ushering in a new era of 490 years. We've had that 490 years of unfaithfulness, which resulted in judgment and captivity. God's now going to give you a new 490 years, and what's it going to result in? Well, it will end with the Messiah coming and all of these things that are offered, and it also will end in judgment because those who reject the Messiah will bring judgment upon themselves, but that salvation will be available. So it's not going to be a group deal, kind of like it was with the people rejecting God the first time. It'll be a more individual basis. So again, the symbolic number here approximates the time period, both the earlier 490 years, which is probably closer to 600 plus years, or the next 500 plus years. So again, the symbolic number is not far off from the actual number of years, but again, the emphasis is really upon the symbolism here. Now, the other thing that's important is to see that the 490 years equals 10 jubilees. Now, a jubilee was every 50th year, and there are actually rabbis who calculated this differently. Some counted a full 50 years before you started the next seven-year cycle. Others said, no, that 50th year is the first year of the next seven-year cycle. And for example, that's how the Day of Pentecost was calculated. You got seven Sabbaths that you count from Passover Sabbath, and then add one day, which always falls on Sunday. But then you don't start the first day of the week the next day and have two Sundays that week. You know, Sunday is still the first day of the next week. And so in the same way, it appears Daniel is following a 49-year jubilee cycle here, and 10 of these, and of course 10 is the number of completeness or perfection. So what would 10 jubilees mean? Well, we'll talk about that here in a minute. Well, the first seven-year period, 7 weeks, would be your first jubilee, and as we said, that seems to indicate the first rebuilding of the temple and the city, which that physical rebuilding kind of becomes a symbol of the ultimate building of a spiritual temple of God's people. But let me put it this way. What would a full, complete, and perfect jubilee bring? So in other words, what does jubilee really represent?
Freedom.
Okay, freedom. Freedom from sin, freedom from death, freedom from Satan, restoration, a new temple. Okay, death. So you think of all the things jubilee means, what would a perfect jubilee be? It would be true rest. Again, you get that whole Sabbath theme of rest. Or true deliverance from slavery, from bondage, from sickness, which again, sickness of sin primarily, bondage of sin, and all that. True forgiveness of debts. Again, on jubilee, debts are remitted. Well, what debt do you have that you really are concerned about? Well, not your mortgage. Sin. Yeah, right. And so, and then true possession of the promised land. Again, ownership of the promised land was re-emphasized at jubilee. Your stake in the promised land of heaven, you know, not some piece of dirt. So all of these things are going to culminate in Jesus. So that has to be what Daniel is getting at here in these 70 weeks here. So it is, again, after all, instead of just being a weird passage, it's a statement of the gospel and of the work of Jesus as the Messiah and all of the things that God has foretold and promised, you know, put in terms of the Old Testament experience and what the Jews would have understood and things of that nature. So hopefully that'll be of some help to you. And I've gone over time, so let them in. Let my people go.